Hello, everyone. Welcome to Teaching Matters. This podcast is produced in the studios of WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. I'm your host, Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University. If you've been a listener of the podcast, you maybe have heard me a few times make reference to my daughter, who is teaching seventh grade social studies at a middle school in a district just east of where Athens is located. And I was having a conversation with her a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about the fact that in her classroom, she has students of varying reading abilities. And she said that, you know, she has a good chunk of students that are reading below grade level. And she just talked about the fact about how that means that she really has to lesson plan for at least three different groups of students. And she also commented on the fact that she and her peers are not necessarily trained on how to remediate students who are reading below grade level. And that was a big conversation that we had. So we're going to be talking about that today. And in fact, this is the second podcast in a two-part series on the science of reading. My guest in today's podcast is Carrie Curto, who actually, interestingly, changed her career from working in Hollywood to becoming a teacher working with children who have dyslexia. Now, Carrie is the National Science of Reading Project Director with the Reading League, a national nonprofit dedicated to helping all students learn to read and all teachers being able to help their students to read. Carrie, thank you for being here.
It's such a pleasure. Scott, thank you so much for having me today.
Absolutely. So when I was prepping for my discussion with you, I was looking through some statistics from the Pew Research Center, and it sort of just, you know, sort of exploded in my head, you know, what I would call as being one of the challenges that we face right now. And it's hard to describe a graph on audio, but I'm going to do my best. So when I look at this graph that reports the statistics from Pew, it shows two consistent things. One is that from 2012 to 2020, the amount of time that students, either 9-year-olds or 13-year-olds, spend reading has dropped. And also, what's pointed out in those stats is that when students progress from 9-year-olds to comparing them to 13-year-olds, the amount of time that they spend reading almost drops in half. And so, you know, putting both of those things together, you conclude that our students are reading less, and that as they get older, the amount of time that they spend reading tends to drop. And so with those stats in mind, I want to start, you know, our discussion today by having you sort of comment on, you know, what maybe some hypotheses are about why students are reading less, and maybe, you know, how you would contextualize that in sort of a longer term trend of how students are getting experience and learning to read.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so true. And I have kids within that age range as well. And so, although being a reading nerd, my kids are readers as well, but just seeing their friends and just noticing what's going on, it's really surprising when I think about the fact that, you know, I couldn't wait to come home from school to read my Babysitter's Club books. Mm-hmm. That's not the motivating factor for a lot of kids these days. So, of course, we have to name that there is a role of screens in all of this, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, my 5-year-old will even try to put on my 11-year-old's VR set, and I'm not sure that there are many books that can compete with, you know, entering a world of cartoons and being immersed in it. I mean, so certainly that is a huge factor. But also, you know, interestingly enough, there's a book by Marianne Wolfe called Reader Come Home. And she kind of dove into this topic a bit, and she noticed that actually the way that people are reading is changing as well, right? I mean, if you think about the fact that we are reading less, but we're also reading less dense texts too, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're on our phone and we're scrolling and we're reading tweets or X's or whatever they're called now in social media, we often are reading in this L-shaped pattern, not really comprehending everything and just scrolling. So, you know, there's certainly that, like our actual process of reading has differed. But, you know, I think it also could have to do with the fact that we are teaching reading in a different way, that many of our pre-service educators, including myself when I was going through my own educator preparation experience, they're not adequately prepared in how children actually learn to read. They're not given information on the structure of the English language and how it breaks down so that they can then teach that to their students, right? And they're not necessarily provided with evidence-based instruction and how to bring that into their classrooms.
You made a reference to an L shape, and I'm assuming that you mean you're scrolling down your feed and then reading left or right. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's what she talks about in the book. And can you just kind of imagine it as you're scrolling through your phone? Do you read every single word all the way across?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And so when students or even adults, for that matter, are reading content like what you would find on social media, I would assume that the type of mental interrogation that goes on with interacting with, you know, a chapter book would be very different, right? I mean, you're not interrogating the text like you would if you were trying to follow a character or follow a plot line. Is that right?
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of plot lines develop over TikTok or YouTube shorts. and most of the information that they're getting is presented to them, and they don't need to kind of think and infer and come up with conclusions on their own that they might with a book. And really the biggest difference is when you and I speak to each other, when you know, my 11-year-old speaks to his friends with, you know, hey, bro, you know, it's not complex language, right? It's not, it's not rich vocabulary. And certainly the syntactic structures, the sentence structures themselves are very different. And so, you know, this is something that we could talk about a little later, but the thing that is missing is that exposure to rich oral language as young kids. And then, you know, as we are teaching our kids to actually decode, which is the process of lifting words off the page, if that doesn't develop adequately, then they won't be able to learn through reading as well, right? Which is what we want them to do, because that's where the good stuff is. That's where that rich language is that they'll really learn from and be able to wrestle with.
So I agree with you, but I'm going to ask a sort of devil's advocate question. Just for sake of discussion. So what if somebody said, well, Carrie, I mean, the reality is that it's more important for students to learn how to interact orally because that's, I don't know, maybe that's a lot of what they will do when they become a young adult. How do you answer that?
Yes, and. I agree. I mean, discourse is extremely important. Kids need to learn how to speak with each other. But if I am a kid and I'm interested in archaeology, if I have a conversation with another, you know, student or a teacher, they're not going to have as much background knowledge and vocabulary specifically related to archaeology as I'd be able to find in a text.
So the two stats that, you know, I talked about in the Pew research were sort of static stats. One of the other statistics that I observed in doing the research was that 64% of eighth graders are reading below grade level. And I started to think about, I mean, you know, if a student is consistently reading below grade level, whether they're an eighth grader, third grader, or whatever, how does that sort of develop? I mean, how does that impact their development as a student holistically as they continue through, you know, the K-12 system and into college? I mean, it seems like they're always a little bit behind. And does that add up, or does that just mean that they're just always behind?
It's very hard for a student to catch up at the point of eighth grade, right? And so what are those implications for those kids? Well, you know, that 64% is not just a static group. They exist on a continuum. And so some of those students may still be reading at a first, second grade level. And so I think the first thing to think about are the impact on mental health. Let's think about an eighth grader that's sitting in a classroom that is watching their peers be able to read and they can't. This is just a fact that many of those kids end up leaving school, getting in trouble. The school to prison pipeline is a real thing. I was just at this remarkable conference in Omaha called Black Literacy Matters, and Hildebrand Peltzer was there, and he said the school to prison pipeline runs through our reading classrooms. Right.
Wow.
And that is powerful to think about. And some of those kiddos are lucky to get to eighth grade. So that, I think, is the most the strongest kind of issue that might arise. But even if a student is low literate, then there's also implications on their adulthood, right? How they're going to access information, how they're going to fill out applications, how they're going to read contracts, leases, the fine print on the credit cards, my goodness, understand medical documents, right? Or even if students then are on their path to higher education, which your daughter probably sees a lot of these students, they want to get into college. But, you know, years ago, TNTP put out this really groundbreaking report called The Opportunity Myth. And I speak with a lot of folks in higher ed frequently, and they kind of iterate the same thing over and over, is that we are giving kids these ideas that they're college ready, but then when they get there, they're absolutely not. They don't have the literacy skills to be able to comprehend what they're reading and to write at a level that they really need to be. And they're spending time and money on remediation when they're at college instead of being able to access those classes that they wanted. And that's not always a successful framework.
Yeah, interesting that you frame it that way. I mean, in my world where we're, you know, dealing with the students once they get to college. Now, I'm blessed in the College of Communication. We tend to get students that have very good oral and written and reading skills once they get here. But even with those students, you will quickly see that the writing skills are maybe not as much as you would. Maybe not as high as you would like for some students. Mm-hmm. And then when you start talking to them, you realize they just don't read very much. And so definitely by the time they get to college, I can see that correlation very easily. So let's turn, before we start talking about the reading lead, there's one other question sort of related to this. I mean, when you look at the statistics and you hear the effects, you know, it is sort of this gloomy scenario. And I always like to try to say, is there anything positive out there? I know we're going to talk about the Reading League and the Compass as a way of, you know, helping going into the future. But I guess, you know, from an asset-based perspective, yeah. what are the assets that we can build on so that we're not sort of starting from this deficit perspective?
Yeah, I'm glad we're making the turn. It does feel really gloomy right now, but I think that we can be excited about the fact that there is really good work going on in some schools, districts, and states. I also convene a community of practice of folks in higher ed that are working diligently and really, really hard to integrate more information on reading research and evidence-aligned practices in their setting. We're seeing some legislation being passed that, if implemented well, could lead to more successful outcomes. And you'll hear me say this frequently, but it's about the word reading, but it's also about language comprehension. And that's what we have been talking about, is ensuring that students are also exposed to rich vocabulary and syntax and developing their oral language and language comprehension skills. So if we continue to do that, I've also seen publishers paying a lot of attention to the research. And this is something that cognitive scientists, neuroscientists, reading researchers that I know have been trying to have into the public's hands for decades. And I think it's really exciting that as long as we do truly understand what the science of reading is and we adhere to all components of the science of reading, then I think that it could be a really exciting thing to make sure that we bring these evidence-based practices into our schools.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, you know, from my own perspective, one other thing that I would say is an asset is that I still find, at least the students, once they get to my classrooms, they're still curious. And I think that when there is curiosity, I mean, all of us that have, you know, spent time in a library as a young child, you know, and young adult, the library is a place where you explore questions and you answer the curiosities that are going on inside your head. And as long as a curiosity is there, I think that's a benefit. Let's talk about the Reading League. So the Reading League is a nonprofit. You're obviously associated with the Reading League. Can you kind of talk in a little bit more detail than my intro about what the mission of the Reading League is and sort of the approaches that organization does to try to accomplish its mission?
Absolutely. So the Reading League is a national nonprofit organization, and our mission is to advance the awareness, understanding, and use of evidence-aligned reading instruction. So we see ourselves as knowledge brokers primarily. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to sell materials or a product. We want to provide the field with knowledge. I worked at a high school for students with learning differences, and I was trained finally in an approach called the Orton-Gillingham approach, and that's where I learned all about the structure of language and mm-hmm. how to teach kids explicitly and systematically. And I was able to teach these older students, 15, 16 years old, that were sometimes coming to me reading at a pre-K first grade level. And because of that knowledge that I had built, I didn't use a curriculum. I used the knowledge that I was given by my OG mm-hmm. fellow, Linda Atamian. And it was so empowering. So, you know, the Reading League does that on a large scale. We want folks to understand that there is a body of knowledge to learn from. We have school-based partnerships, but we have an incredible chapter network. So we have chapters in 33 or more states now, with interest in other states. We can only onboard 5 per year, capacity wise, but they are incredible experts that are part of the Reading League chapter network in each state. We also have conferences, summits, we have online learning, and we have a lot of reliable, no-cost resources. And that's sort of mm-hmm. the world that I live in, is trying to develop these guidance materials and resources for the field to understand what the science of reading is, what it's not, and what practices we can uplift from the science to help us teach our kids in a way that's most aligned with the evidence.
So, I mean, you intentionally use the word evidence aligned, yeah. and sort of as a, I don't know, as somebody that does social scientific research, I would say, well, of course people should be using that. Is it not the case that, you know, evidence aligned practices have been the part and parcel of how we've trained teachers and then implemented lessons in classrooms?
Yeah, that's right. And so when we say evidence-aligned, we are talking about scientifically-based evidence. So we're talking about learning from empirical research. My friend Susan Brady has taught me an expression that's the plural of anecdote is not evidence. So what we like to learn from are these empirical studies, right? If you've ever conducted research, you know that it is not a light lift. You need a question. Mm-hmm. You need a team. You need to get grant funding. You conduct the research. You look at the data. You write it up. You get it peer reviewed and published. I mean, so this is solid evidence that has gone through a lot of review and process in order to answer those questions. Mm-hmm. And there has been a ton of research. This is the most widely researched topic in education, is how kids learn to read. And that's largely stayed in scientific journals kind of untouched, right? Mm-hmm. While other, let's say influencers have come up with instructional materials and approaches and philosophies of teaching reading and theories that have taken the ed prep world by storm. But some of those theories and philosophies, they've not exactly been aligned to the scientific evidence. So it is surprising, and folks are surprised when they hear that. But when educators go through this training, many of them say, wow, why didn't I learn this in college? And where has this been my whole teaching career, because I've had these kids that are struggling and I didn't know how to help them, and now I do.
So as I'm old enough that I remember, as I went through my educational experiences, phrases like phonics and whole language instruction, I just remember those, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not an expert in either one. I mean, my field is communication but not reading instruction. Are those I guess theories or perspectives still relevant? And does the Reading League, based upon its knowledge of the scientific evidence, ascribe to a particular philosophy or theoretical perspective that is more effective?
Yeah. So I think it's, to me, I'm gonna just kind of wonder about that term of philosophy, right?
Sure.
I'm a fan of philosophy. I like to debate and ponder life, right? But This is really important. We have to get this right, right? My friend, Dr. Tracy White Whedon, is an incredible speaker and expert. And she says, as goes literacy, so goes our country. I love that, right? So for something as important as developing literacy, and it has such enormous implications on our individual and collective future, I'm going to say we need more than just a philosophy, right? If this was medicine, would we listen to a doctor based on a philosophy, or would we listen to somebody that's undergone years of training in research-based methods? So mm-hmm. I think that's the importance of listening to the research. You know, we have research on how, you know, a typical learner learns to read, on how struggling learners learn to read, whether they are struggling with word level reading or language, on how English learners learn to read, for students with language variations, right? We don't know everything, but we know a lot. And so those mm-hmm. practices are what the Reading League tries to lift up. I'm going to mention one of our resources. It's called the Curriculum Evaluation Guidelines. And I think that this kind of addresses your question the most directly. If you look mm-hmm. at this research, the second half of it almost is all citations, and the citations are all empirical, scientifically based research, meta-analyses, and that body of knowledge that we're referencing, that's the science of reading. And from mm-hmm. that, we uplift both practices that are aligned to that evidence directly from the research, and also practices that are not aligned to the science of reading. And those approaches are in our instructional materials in our schools, mm-hmm. like right now. And so yeah. this resource helps folks understand what those are and what they're not. What they're not is whole language, right? Whole language is not aligned to the science of reading. If you watch presentations by Dr. Stanislaus Dehaan, there's a copious amount of research that's cited on the curriculum evaluation guidelines, on Dr. Reed Lyon's 10 maxims, that shows that when we read, the most proficient readers are actually decoding letter sound by letter sound until this process happens called orthographic mapping, where they can then read that word as if by sight, but it doesn't right. go the other way around, right? We don't memorize words to read them. We have to go through this process for them to activate as if by sight. Mm-hmm. So that is an example of something that is aligned or not aligned. But again, this is not just about phonics. It's not just about word reading. We also know that students need exposure to things like text structures and corresponding signal words. So the curriculum evaluation guidelines uplift all of those. We need to teach our students spelling. We need to teach them how to write a sentence. We need to teach them the reciprocal process between written expression and reading comprehension. So there's a lot we can learn from the science, and a lot of that is detailed in the curriculum evaluation guidelines.
So, you just said a whole bunch, and I want to ask like a gazillion questions to follow up on this. So I want to zero in on one example that you just said, signal words. Can you define that for the listeners?
Yeah, so those are words like when you're thinking about cause and effect, affect text structure. Mm-hmm. Those are the signal words that are going to signify what that relationship in the text is. So those words like, however, as one example, there's a whole list of them that I can't call to mind right now, they are those really important function words that if you don't comprehend or understand those, you're not going to know the relationship between the sentences within the text. And so thinking about those words, those need to be explicitly taught in practice because they're going to have a huge effect on your students' comprehension. We're talking about English speaking students, but especially our multilingual learners as well, right? We need to spend a lot of time and attention making sure that they understand those words that connect ideas in a text.
Yeah. So just a quick statement on for me, it's been a hot minute since my dissertation, but my dissertation actually looked at signal words in oral lectures. And just to kind of put it in perspective, I think that what you're saying is absolutely true, and it goes back to something you said before, where if a student does not learn how to interpret the importance of signals in a written text, mm-hmm. I think it's very unlikely that they will understand how to use those in an oral type of situation. And in my dissertation, the reason why that was important is it directly impacted note taking. So mm-hmm. when I trained students to look for signal words, like their notes would dramatically improve in both the number of details recorded, but also like the organizational format of their notes. It was a dramatic increase. And it seems like a simple thing, and it seems like it should be a common sense thing, but clearly it wasn't. And so that's one example of why I totally buy into what you're saying. Let me ask another question, just sort of from a more general social scientific standpoint. Like, I know when I look at a body of literature on any topic in the social sciences, I'm going to find studies that, you know, some report significant results, others don't. Sometimes there's conflicting results. How do you, as an organization, reconcile sort of the body of literature, given that there's always going to be some variance within the literature on exact findings?
Yeah, absolutely. Science evolves, and we need to be flexible to that. So you're absolutely right. We try to look to that research that there has really been just so much conducted on this particular mm-hmm. topic that there is mostly a consensus on them. So looking at those meta-analyses or longitudinal mm-hmm. studies that give us so much great data, those are the studies that we mostly look to try to find the most evidence-aligned practices.
And for readers that aren't familiar with what a meta-analysis is or a longitudinal, do you have a quick definition of what you mean by that?
Let's say meta-analyses are, you're looking at a large body of research on the same topic and reporting the overall findings from that large body. And longitudinal.
Like hundreds of studies that you sort of average together.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And longitudinal is when you follow a representative group of students across a long period of time mm-hmm. And note the data from that long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about one of the resources created by the Reading League, which was the assessment checklist, the curriculum assessment checklist. Am I getting that right?
Curriculum evaluation guidelines. Yes.
Okay. I was sort of kind of close.
You were there. You were in the neighborhood. Like Mr. Rogers.
Thank you. One of the other products, and in fact, the reason that you're on the show right now is the compass that is created by the Reading League. Can you sort of describe what the compass is?
Oh, I sure can. The compass is my baby. I love talking about it. So it started because the science of reading has really taken off across the country, like this term. So we created the defining guide that defined what the science of reading is and what it is not. We created the curriculum evaluation guidelines, but we've watched this term continue to grow. And in some places, it has become this beacon of hope, right? In schools and districts, it has transformed practices. It has empowered educators. It has given mm-hmm. us these incredible data-driven positive outcomes. And that's the thing. You really need to look at the data. We need proof that this is working, and it's been skyrocketing in some places. In other circles, however, the science of reading is much more misunderstood. It's called a program of instruction or, you know, only focusing on phonics, and it's just not true. But it's become a lightning rod because of these misconceptions that have spread by various groups. And that's problematic. So I think the difference between these like dichotomous views are that in the first example, leaders and educators first focus on growing their knowledge and understanding everything that's needed to develop an evidence-aligned system, a whole mm-hmm. system, right? We're not just talking about instructional materials, because any administrator can and probably has daily fielded a phone call from a publisher saying that they're selling the science of reading in a box and this is all you need. But right. if we truly understand the science of reading as this body of knowledge from over 50 years, like, you can't box that, and you certainly can't teach that to kids. So the yeah. Reading League Compass is a resource that provides direction. Get it? Compass, providing direction mm-hmm. to a variety of stakeholder groups. We have a page for educators and specialists. It's a place for them to kind of nerd out and find some really great, reliable resources. We have a page for administrators, which I think is so important that they understand that this is about who they're hiring and how they're training their teachers, the essential role of coaching. Coaching is key in all of this. Mm-hmm. What assessment data to collect and how to use that data, how to build a multi-tiered system of support, how to implement these practices. So the administrator page addresses all of that. We have a page for those supporting English learners and emergent bilingual students. There's a mm-hmm. lot of misinformation in that field. We've been working with folks from that field for a couple of years. We came up with a joint statement that tries to clarify some of the misunderstandings. But we have a whole a whole bunch of research that's listed there that you can read about how English learners learn to read. We have a page for educator preparation programs. We have model syllabi and other resources for those incredible educators that are aligning their syllabi and course content to the science of reading. Lots of great resources there to check out for folks in higher ed. And we also have a page for policymakers and legislators and state education agencies with guidance on policy, right? You can't just ban the three queuing approach and call it a day. That's what some states are doing. You have to take a more comprehensive approach because otherwise, you know, the science of reading, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes, you can't see me, but it's not going to work because it's not a thing. It's not a thing that you can teach or buy. It is a body of knowledge you have to grow, and you have to address all of these things in your system in order for it to be effective. So we have one more page that is releasing on May 1st, which is very exciting. And that page is going to be for curriculum decision makers. That's going to house our latest resource. And these are all no cost because we are a nonprofit and we just want good information to get out into the field. These are called curriculum navigation reports. And what we've done is taken the curriculum evaluation guidelines, and we have actually trained teams of reviewers across the country to open up our most widely used instructional materials across the U.S. And they have actually reviewed them against the curriculum evaluation guidelines. And we are coming out with these narrative informational reports for schools and districts to use.
Mm-hmm. So you actually answered one of my questions. I was going to say this must be really expensive, right?
No, it's all free.
so just a couple scenarios then. So going back to my daughter, seventh grade social studies teacher, what's a way that she might interact with a compass that could be beneficial as she starts to plan her next academic year?
Well, she's going to have better luck in the fall when we come out with another new page for secondary students. Certainly, the curriculum evaluation guidelines could be a place to start to look at those evidence-based practices. But there are some really special there's some special information that we need to know in how to support our middle and high school students because it's just their learning profiles are so complex, and we need to do this in much more of a hurry. So for middle and secondary students, it's a whole team effort. I spoke with Sharon Vaughn, who's a famous researcher from the University of Texas, and she said that we can't just leave it up to the interventionists, and we can't just leave it up to tier one. Everybody has to come together to understand their students, what their needs are, whether it's decoding, fluency, writing, sentence writing, vocabulary, background knowledge. What's the greatest need in your school, and how can you come together as a school to support that need, even if it's just one thing at a time?
So that sort of actually leads directly into my next question. So it seems to me that if a school is going to take the science of reading seriously and really try to use evidence-informed practices to benefit their students, it really takes leadership from everyone.
Yes.
But it seems like the principal and you know, curriculum chairs inside schools, they really have to buy into this, right? So what you know, based upon what your knowledge base is, what are some ways that administrators can really lead this at the school level, you know, to make it effective?
There's a lot of initiatives at state departments of education and a lot of legislation that is focused on educator training. And I really hope that all of those administrators will undergo that training with their teachers. I have seen some really, really great outcomes at schools, and all of those schools have had administrators that were, to use your word earlier, curious, right? We can't lose that curiosity as an adult did not have... I don't know, for lack of a better word right now, ego, where they would then learn from their reading specialists that have perhaps undergone some of this training already and allowed them to leverage their expertise to help develop these evidence line systems. But they really need to understand what their teachers are learning as they're learning it, because there is a phrase that is, when you know better, you do better. But many educators across the country, they want to do better. They know how to do better. But their administrators are, again, getting swayed by some for-profit company, perhaps. And they don't create an environment that is conducive to the teachers being able to do better.
So if I'm thinking about this from the parents' perspective, so I think that obviously schools have a responsibility to use, you know, evidence-informed practices like you're talking about. But what if I'm a parent and I'm just not sure what's going on? I mean, hopefully I would know what's going on in my child's classroom, but that's a different discussion. What should I be doing as a parent to try to help my child be a better reader?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of parents have these questions for their very young kiddos. You know, what can I do to set my kids up for success? And I think some of those important things are, you know, keep singing the alphabet song. We need them to know their letters, but also let's have them be curious about letter sounds. You know, when you're naming objects in your environment, oh, what is that? A table. What sound does that start with? T, right? And starting to get them on this trajectory of understanding those individual speech sounds called phonemes in our language, because that's going to really be helpful. And so those are things that they can they do to help develop their reading brains. Also, talk to your kids, both your little kids and your elementary age kids, that role of oral language, as you said, read the world, discuss everything you can with them, and continue to develop their oral language, because when they do crack the code, right, if they have evidence-aligned instruction in their schools and they crack that code and they are able to turn these squiggles into language, what they're reading is language. So the more they have of it and the more, you know, deep and rich it is, the easier it's going to be for them to comprehend the text once they're able to get that code down. Of course, read to them often, books of all genres, fiction, nonfiction, develop their background knowledge and subjects that they're interested in. There's definitely research to support engagement. So there are roles for books like Dogman and Captain Underpants. My kids love them, right? But also let's think about the fact that we want them to also grow their knowledge, vocabulary, and syntax. And we want to encourage them to read more complex books as they get older, right? Because it's not all that it takes, right? We can't just read to our kids. So, you know, I've seen IEP goals that's like, well, read more to your kids. We're going to read more to the student. And that's important, but it is surely not all that they need. Reading is complex. Louisa Moats wrote an article called Teaching Reading is Rocket Science. It is complex, but it is so worth it, right? It's the most worthwhile goal that we can have. I think parents could also use the curriculum evaluation guidelines to kind of see what's going on in their school and if it aligns with what we have. And then also the Reading League, funny enough, we have a free show on YouTube called Reading Buddies that will actually help kiddos learn to read. It's on some PBS stations across the country, but we also have all of the episodes on YouTube. It was a product of the pandemic, and just kind of a pet project, but it's been going really well, and it's helped to teach a lot of kids learn how to read.
Carrie, I think the last question I had before we started the recording, you and I were talking about the state of Ohio, and I can you comment on what you see happening in the political landscape, you know, across the country as it relates to evidence-informed reading instruction?
Yeah, absolutely. Governor DeWine has come out in support of the science of reading, which I think is admirable and wonderful. The State Department of Education has some great folks that have put together some pretty amazing plans. So I know that there has been some pushback from some organizations, and I'm not sure of the current status of the work, but I think it's really admirable for these state leaders that take a moment to understand what it takes to develop skilled literacy, and place a critical and essential importance on that, both through policy and funding. We're seeing mm-hmm. this in Indiana too. They have a public-private partnership that has the Lilly Endowment has granted funds to support this work, and gosh, they are just doing exceptional work there. Mm. Then there are other states that are a little bit of a hot mess, right? Because there are organizations that are at odds. There's a lot of, again, misconceptions being spread about a fear, right? It's a fear that this is just going to be a pendulum swing back to phonics, which phonics are extremely necessary, but that's not even all it takes to develop decoding, right? So use the Reading League's resources to help align messaging and understand truly what the science of reading is, that it is that comprehensive approach to reading instruction that includes solid foundational skills instruction, but also oral language, language writing. It all needs to happen, background knowledge, subjects and content knowledge. And if we can do that, then the sky's the limit for our kiddos.
So, is there anything that you were really excited to talk about that I haven't asked you about yet?
You know, I think that we covered most of it.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on because, you know, as I looked through, especially the Compass, but really the entire organization, I mean, there's so many resources available there for, as you mentioned, for all types of people. It doesn't matter whether you're a teacher or an administrator or policymaker, whatever. I mean, I just think it's really great information. I just want to commend you on not only compiling that, but also creating a resource that is user-friendly and provides people with great information. And I encourage our readers to, our listeners to take a look at the product, and we'll have it linked in the text. So, Carrie, thank you for being a guest today.
It was my honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. My guest today was Carrie Curto. She's the National Science of Reading Project Director for the Reading League. And as I mentioned, we'll have a link to both Carrie's bio and also to the Compass and to the Reading League in the text accompanying the podcast. Thank you for listening today. Our audio engineer and associate producer is Adam Rich. Our assistant producers are April Koska and Trinity Sweet. I'm your host, Scott Titsworth. We hope you have a great day.